This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you so much. I didn't come with a prepared text, and the question of memory in architecture is certainly one that I think every one of us who uses buildings, who has been in a city, who has dreamt, already is an expert at. So I was thinking, what could I really illuminate here in such a format? I actually thought it would be more interesting to have a conversation or a discussion, a dialogue, because architecture is an art which I think is very resistant to theory. We have a lot of books on architecture, a lot of theoretical books, books by theoreticians of architecture or by dreamers or utopian architects, so-called, who never built, for example. But when you look at the world of architecture, if you look at the last, let's say, not too long, 10,000 years, or even more, 50,000 years of known recorded human attempt at dwelling, you see actually very little change. Till today. Of course, our buildings are bigger, and we use glass and steel, and they're different. But really, the elemental connection to nature, the elemental connection of human beings to themselves, has changed very little if we compare this field to fields such as economics or sciences, medicine, genetics, astronomy, and anything else we might actually see on television or on the internet. So the question really is, why, given there's such a depth of memory in architecture, there has been relatively little change in the built environment? And of course, this might sound slightly strange to us, because we believe everyone always believes they live in the ultimate stage of development. But let us put ourselves in the shoes of a Roman, living in the Forum back in the first century AD. What Roman, looking at Rome, would have ever thought that world would come to an end? It's not considered. None of them did. They looked out at Rome, they looked at those incredible walls, at those incredible items of architecture, the planning genius of the Roman, and it would have never occurred to a single one of them that world was doomed and destined to a complete ruin, to a vanishing. Now, the same thing can be true of anyone. It can be true of those great castles in Europe. Who in those castles, looking at the landscape out there, ever thought that world would ever, ever come to a destined end? Because we're talking about the end a little bit. And what dweller today of Philadelphia, New York, Paris, London, would, looking out of these skyscrapers in Chicago, looking at the city, ever think that this world is doomed and destined to disappear? Well, it's a question. It's a question about the relative stability of the spiritual notion of dwelling and the relative instability of and suddenness of transformation in architecture. Now, I said architecture is resistant to theory, because whatever can be read, whatever can be described, whatever can be filed in a library or in an index or a kind of encyclopedia, has a life of its own, whereas buildings, to some extent, are also not human. They are inanimate. They don't connect. They are not part and parcel of language the way other discourses are. Even music is closer to reality than, which is only sound, of course, but it is closer, seemingly, in terms of our own emotions than buildings. And yet, buildings occupy such a predominant role in our everyday life. We wonder why we were born into this environment. Why does it look this way? Why couldn't it have looked in any other way? And why are we destined to live within these walls, looking at this landscape, looking out of this wall, and framing the view in this particular way? Well, it's a question, because it's not really easy one to answer. I just posed to you really the issues that must have to do with tradition. And of course, memory and architecture are within a tradition. And yet, what is tradition? As one great philosopher said, tradition is the forgetting of the origins. So the simultaneity of the originality of an act and the tradition which establishes a kind of amnesia vis-a-vis the reasons for the acts which brought it to bear is precisely, I think, involved in architecture and why architecture is so difficult to change, why it has changed very little. I'm speaking again about the difficulty of changing architecture. Now, I've often thought a writer can sit down and write something. It's relatively easy to sit down and write something, even if it is not published. And if were it to be published, one could even find some publisher who would perhaps publish it, maybe an esoteric one or a lunatic one, but or a small press of only for only three people, or a samizdat type of operation. But one could disseminate a piece of writing. If one wrote a piece of music, well, perhaps not a symphonic one, one could still get it to some extent performed. Through, particularly today, with new possibilities of technology. If one wanted to philosophize, to think in the scientific manner, one could do it. But if one would enter the field of architecture and want to change just a very, very small thing, let's say make the window at not 90 degrees like we see here, but at 89 degrees, you would find it extremely difficult to do it for many, many reasons. I've tried to discover why it's so difficult. You know, it's just 1 degree. It really doesn't really matter. It's hardly visual. Nobody would even notice if that window was at 89 or 88 degrees, not at 90. But it would be almost impossible because it, of course, involves the entire apparatus of convention, stability, institutionalization, and ritual, which has to do with how things have been done, how they have always been done, how they always should be, how they signal through some very mysterious and often inscrutable way a kind of agreement about the most tacit and the most unspeakable of realities. And I therefore believe that Freud was right when he compared the psyche to the city. You know, in that famous study on Gradiva by Janssen, a famous book on psychology, which Freud sort of wrote an analysis of. And it's, by the way, about an archaeologist who falls in love with a relief, and then goes to Pompeii to try to find the woman who he has fallen in love in this relief, and indeed finds her. And it happens to be that, to make a long story short, it's an incestuous love affair with someone in his own town. But in this particular book, Freud makes it very, very clear that the city can be, that the mind can be only understood in really an archaeological and urban way, that it has layers and it has stabilities and it has places which are so hidden that no one really knows because they are the foundations and therefore, by definition, not visible to anyone constructing something on top of them. So the difficulty of doing anything in architecture which would attempt, and that's my attempt, to get closer to a human discourse, to remember that architecture, after all, is not a technical profession. It's not about immediately mathematics, knowledge of materials, gravity, volumes, and all those things that people say, oh yes, architects, those are those people in those offices figuring these things out. But that architecture has always been, and always considered to have been, the deepest and closest thing to not only the psyche and the emotions, but to the body itself and to human beings as they are entering this world and passing through it and out of it. So that change of architecture from the most immediate and the most maternal, the most primordial matrix of all, to something which today has become rather an abstract field, something which is detached. We prefer to talk about movies. We prefer to discover a restaurant than to discover an 89-degree angle. And there is the question, what happened? Where has that culture of architecture vanished to since human desires haven't really changed, as I mentioned before? People still have that relationship with wherever they live, whether it's a city, a place, an imaginary topos, or indeed their more secret archive in physical embodiments. So architecture, what is it, where is it, and what is the function of memory, given that the tradition is very often the obliterating mechanism of that memory? Now, I have been privileged to work on a number of projects, but all projects in architecture deal with memory. Really, whatever it is, the most prosaic project is also dealing with memory. I happen to have one because I'm working on, I won a competition recently for one of the largest shopping centers to be constructed in Europe. It's not really a shopping center, but it's kind of a city of the future with leisure facilities, housing, offices, hotels, places to be. And it's an economic engine also, right at the entrance to the capital of Switzerland, to Bern. And there too, seemingly in the middle of nowhere, kind of on a highway, people say, well, here anything can be done because, you know, it's a virgin territory. Just there's land. It's never been built upon. But when you go there and you think about it, you realize that this place has seen a lot of history. There is a lot of memory in it. It's not just the green fields at the bottom of valleys with the views of Alps. It's all a very constructed theme. The landscape of history also is part of that construction of where it appears. And so nothing really is just where it appears to be. It is already part and parcel of a depth. And that depth is astonishing because it's not a depth that we could really refer to by thematizing certain objective spaces. And by the way, in that quote, and that's a very old one that you quoted about something coming in to an end, but who knows what it is because it's not in the realm of objects, so it cannot really be objectified. It's not just one more thing we can file away into our statistical matrix. It's something that has to do with the spiritual. And I do believe that, of course, architecture is the most spiritual field, precisely because it appears to have nothing to do with it. It just appears to be calculations, sheer folly, sheer exertion into the nowhere, and a kind of opacity which is oblivious to human interests and oblivious to human critique. Because you can criticize a book, you can write another book, you can have a discourse in an intellectual level, but buildings are oblivious to discourse. Think about it. Unless you take a hammer, which they did in history too, and chip away at a building and get rid of it, it's there standing and also moving and looking towards its own destiny, which seems to be sometimes at cross purposes with the realities for which it was built. I was always astonished when I was a student to find on the cover of Witkover's great book on architecture and humanism a picture of the arcades of the Colosseum. I shuddered to think that a building which was built as a machine to destroy people and to kill, just like concentration camps. I mean, it's a different time, a different form of organization, a different kind of entertainment. But in any case, that a Colosseum, a murderous piece of invention, should have been illustrated how many thousand years later? 2,000 years later? Not even. 1940s, I guess it was, that book, Architecture of Humanism, with all its arcades, as signifying something really beautiful and wonderful with its completely monolithic, functional way of getting people quickly to the galleries. There's the stair course, of course. There's the first place where staircases were used in inefficient ways, and arcades also to surround, to create a perimeter which is really accessible and so on. So how curious, how interesting. And of course, it is about forgetting, because if were we to remember as tourists in Rome, and were we really to see it outside of the Hollywood image of the gladiator, which you probably saw, just won the Oscar. But I thought it was fantastic when, what is the name of the actor who stars in it? Russell Crowe, when he enters the Colosseum. I don't remember whether you remember it, but he walks in, and it's a beautiful simulation of Rome, and he stands and he looks at it, and he says, I can't believe that human beings actually built this thing. And I thought that's a quintessential commentary on architecture, and also, of course, the problem of architecture is thematized here, not only as a literary problem, but also as a problem of functionality, a problem of history. Now, I said I was lucky because I'm working on a number of projects which are thematically dealing with memory, whether it is the Felix Nussbaum Museum, which is about a single individual. He's not a statistic of the Holocaust. He was a Jew who was born into this town, believed in it, was brought up in it, was exiled from it, was murdered by his own co-citizens, And yet, somehow, by who knows what craziness of history, his paintings wound up back in Osnabrück, and I was lucky to win a competition to build a building for it. But again, how does one deal with it? Well, I didn't do a building, a museum. Of course, there are 350 paintings, drawings, and so on. The whole legacy or whatever has been saved by others of Nussbaum, who perished, by the way, in the last transport to Auschwitz. He was hiding and escaped. And it's a very interesting story of a human being who thought that resilience of art and culture and intelligence would conquer over human evil. And he really believed it. He painted it. He believed that he would document it. And despite all that happened to him, he would tell the story. And he did, in a way he did. But he himself did not survive. He was murdered with his wife, Elka Platek. And I built a museum there. And again, the museum is not a conventional museum because I proposed to the city to build a museum that has no exit. That, well, unless you enter it, you can't find your way out. Which is not really a conventional thing to do because people immediately are horrified. You know, we're going to get lost in a museum. We won't find our way. And I said, yes, that's exactly the reason it should be built, to be lost so that you find out that you can't leave this history because this history ties back into the older history of Osnabrück. And, of course, Osnabrück, as some of you may know, is the place where the oldest evidence of the Germanic peoples have been found. That's the oldest coins, the oldest place of German mythology in Germany. And I thought that because it's connected to the Kunsthistorisches Museum, it's very important that the public loses its orientation, loses its evident balance of today and tomorrow and yesterday, and finds itself in a state of transformation, because that is really the state in which architecture participates as well. It's not only an object, it's not only a vessel and a inanimate, neutral object into which to put something, but it's actually, because it's bodily and spiritual as we are, it has the same sort of density, the same index of refractory qualities and the same inertness, but also the same spiritual capacity to change itself. So again, there is a programmatic way in which memory built into a sort of neutrality of the observer, which by definition museums encourage and amplify, I thought could change with the building. And we've seen the failure at attempts by postmodernism to try to transform architecture through quotation. And you have some buildings by Venturi here, and he's in the city, so you know it better than I do. But the kind of failed attempt at intellectualizing architecture by lifting a certain coded messages out of that theory of architecture. And I've always thought that the irony of that theory is that it is itself ironic because it doesn't do what it pretends or pretends to do. It reduces itself finally to the same banality to which it gave resistance. So on one hand, we have the kind of postmodernist approach. If we dispense now with the long, venerable tradition of architecture, which is long gone, at least since they're called the Beaux-Arts and called the Polytechnique in France, and those revolutionary architects of the 18th century who took on that whole theme of revolution in architecture. On the other hand, we have the technocratic, I would say, obsession with creating an illusory world by materiality, by spending a lot of money on facades of buildings, how they look, how they should glow and glisten, and how they should appear to the touch. So both of these, I think, are extremes. Both in each one in its own way, I think, a decadent extreme, because they take architecture out of that central arena, which is a struggle. And it is a struggle. It is, as I said, very difficult to change a position of a doorway, to make a door slightly lower, and I'm not talking about large moves in architecture, but just very, very small ones. And people immediately are up at arms, authorities, particularly public authorities, and of course building, unless you're building a private house, are part of the public realm. So it is a public issue, a political issue, from the very, very beginning. And it should be, because politeia is the city, is everybody's interest. Architecture is not just for the rich, for the elite. It is touching everybody's life. And if it stands on a street, if it's part of that realm, it has to also respond in a responsible way. Now, in the Jewish Museum, a very different mission, to give embodiment to what is largely not visible any longer in that form. It's visible in other forms, but it is not visible in that form, and how to connect the city back across a space which will forever be an abysmal empty, as it'll never be filled up. And never, no matter how many buildings are built on Potsdamer Platz, will Berlin be any different than that hollowness, because that hollowness is part of its history. And building buildings and filling empty sites cannot really prevent the void from opening and yawning at that whole built-up reality. Now, I'm not pessimistic. I love Berlin, and I like the courage of Berliners to go on. But again, in creating that museum, one of my responsibilities was how to tie the city to something which is really not evident, because no matter how many exhibits come into the museum, and by the way, the museum will open this September 9th, no longer empty, we'll have exhibits as any other museum. But nevertheless, whatever it has will still speak to that which can never be really shown, because it is not in the realm of objects. Because what happened in that horror and that evil was the destruction of the spiritual carriers. And that's very different from destroying menorahs and tallits and other items which can still recall a way of life. Because ultimately the way of life refers to people. And people are not objects. They have never been, and they refuse to align themselves in the world of objects. So that's another approach, the creation of the void, the creation of a completely different circulation system in the museum, which is unlike any other. Again, by the way, just as a personal story, it's not that easy to do it, because the minute you plan to do something else, you will have an opposition, because people want it to be done exactly as it was done yesterday and the day before and the day before. And I wonder, you know, you are writers and people in different walks of life, so you might help us architects in seeing why the world of mobility and dynamism is inscribed into the discourse, while architecture seems to present its backside to it. It's seen sort of inside out, not outside in. And that is, of course, why we also look in retrospect at architecture as a huge projector, giving us an insight into things which books or other human documents can no longer do. Don't we really, when we go to Rome, look at Roman architecture, or to Egypt at Egyptian, or, you know, wherever we might go, American native art, look at where they lived, because that tells us something across the devastations, catastrophes, somehow that connects us to something which, as vulnerable as it is, because it is inscribed, after all, in a material datum, and what isn't, almost everything, but not everything, it gives us some clue to a true discourse and a true desire. Well, I think I've already went more than my 15 minutes, but really, I didn't have anything prepared. But it's true that not only looking back at the tragic periods, but looking forward, look at the Victoria and Albert Museum. I'm building a very contemporary building, the Spiral, and even though it looked to the Londoners at the beginning shockingly different, after a number of years, it takes a long time to build a public building in England, and it's going to be constructed very soon, people realize it does have a lot to do, you know, because the Spiral is not just a rhetorical spiral, but it refers also, by the way, I didn't know about it, to the spiral which was proposed for that very site, in a different form, of course, by Henry Cole, the founder of the Victoria and Albert Museum. I discovered it only in retrospect. Probably I would have never designed a spiral had I known that a spiral had been proposed for that site by the original architect of the museum. But nevertheless, there's some strange coincidence in the life of cities and in culture. So again, one could look at new buildings, new programs, and think of how is one to inscribe memory. And I do believe that architecture is, despite everything, something that is also like a text, but it is not a text that can be easily read, because its codes are non-existent and its memory is obliterated in its own tradition. So the notion of what architecture might be, how it might communicate, I think involves other levels than simply the ones which are intellectual and semantic. I think that's very important, because architecture is really made also for those aspects of our personalities and our living beings which are not thematized, because they are for us as we walk, as we kinetically move across space, as we breathe, as we listen. So the acoustical, kinetic, bodily movement through architecture, I think that's, again, something that has been completely underestimated. People have concentrated on the theoretical, which means usually the visual aspect of architecture, that which can be put into a codex of some sort, that which can be detached from its own disintegration or dissolution into otherness. And nevertheless, I think architecture is, like everything else, predominantly not intellectual and not semantic and not really in the realm of the reflective, but in the realm of the felt, the desired. And I always feel, you know, whenever a book of mine comes out, I always feel slightly cheated because it's always photographic and literary and textual. And yet I know very well, as do most visitors and people who I speak to, that at least my buildings don't have to, I'm not really dealing with picturable things. Of course, you can take a picture of it. But it's not about the picture. It's not about the way the plans look in a monograph. It's not about even my own self-reflection on the buildings very often, because they're only things that have come into language after a certain mediating process. So I do believe that, that architecture, to be really memorable and to function really in its really authentic traditional role, and I am really a great traditionalist because I believe that that tradition is what holds us together in the space of the politeia, of the city, of the landscape, gives us some ethic to the architecture. Otherwise, well, who was it who said, I think it was Heraclitus who said, the ears and the eyes are not good witnesses for a barbarian soul. I'm paraphrasing very, very loosely. But, you know, what witness would the eye and the ear be if the soul was a barbaric one? Now, that is as brilliant as a statement as anybody has ever made. As mystical as it is, I can well understand what he was, well, not well understand. I can try to understand a little bit of what might have been meant by that thought. Even in its, you know, many translations, somehow that that the witness is not just our sort of psychophysical organism. And there again, the word spiritual, which whenever I use it, you know, I dread because everybody sort of, I can see the expressions on the faces of people just drop because it's one of the most hideous words in any language. We've lost all, it has lost all authority. It looks ludicrous. Just in the, you know, it's just something really not credible. And yet, when one thinks about it, whatever that word stands for, and whatever other words we could find which we would agree perhaps a little bit more precisely, would still connect us, I think, to that area of memory, which I think architecture is the prefigurement of. Architecture is at the forefront of that because it allows us. It's not a repository of the memory. It's also the transformer of memory and actually the creator of memory. That's something which nostalgic people don't often think about, that the architecture is also the future of memory because it is the creating the possibility of remembering precisely by dispatching itself from the known models and materials of what is worthy of remembrance and providing something which appears for the first time worthy of coming into contact with. And I think that's really the creative aspect, the dynamic aspect of architecture, that no matter how many times you can have carved a piece of reality out and polished it, somehow reality moves on and it's changing all the time. And the changes are dramatic, I think. They're not the changes in the technology sector or business sector, but I think that the dramatic changes of the soul are probably the most responsible for the dramatic changes in the space of the city. Because if I were to tell you that tomorrow no one will build skyscrapers, you will just say this is ridiculous. But it could be, because it'll be just like that. It'll be on a moment's notice where the soul just can't build another skyscraper. And there'll be things of the past. And there will be a moment where people will not have the desire to build such a thing anymore. It takes a lot of effort to get yourself into the mood to build something. It took a long effort to get oneself to build in certain axial plans, to get a certain authority And by the way, it takes sometimes hundreds and thousands of years to get to that effort. And once that effort is expanded, one might see that there are more open horizons. So yes, one should be very optimistic, because architecture is really not something which cannot be touched. It's not a big thing, actually. I discovered this, because everybody told me it was a very big thing, and that you couldn't, you know, that architecture was always with a capital A, and it was this overall process. But really, I think every human being should be doing architecture, is doing architecture already, in every way. And I have always been an advocate that architecture should leave the realm of the profession. I'm against the privatization, the kind of licensing, that old system which controls architecture, so that only the so-called professionals are able to do it. I'm for the citizens doing architecture. I even did a project in Groningen many years ago where I was asked to plan a piece of the city. And I said, why should you ask me? I'll just get, you know, artists, economists, philosophers, you know, playwrights to build. And they said, but they can't build. They can write, they can philosophize, they can economize. But they can. I said, we'll prove that they can. And they did. You know, Heiner Müller did a wonderful piece of architecture. Paul Virilio did an incredible fountain in the middle of the city. Akira Asada, the Japanese economist, did an incredible piece. So I think just a lot of myths about architecture and where the borderland, the threshold of architecture and reality lies. So that's all that really I sort of had as a small reflection as I was on a plane. I just came about an hour ago from the old world, and as I was thinking, you know, who will I encounter here? But I know there's so many interesting people. I would love to sort of get into, if we have a few minutes, to hear from.
I have a mic in my hand. If you can raise your hand, I'll walk around handing the mic. Exactly conducive to dialogue, but it is important to give an online. Anybody?
Okay. Thanks. I don't know if this would be a good topic of conversation, dialogue between us, may give you a chance to talk a little bit more on your own, which is fine with me because I like listening. I used to work for the Jewish Museum San Francisco. I did communications there, and I remember you coming onto the project there, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit today about that specific project, perhaps how it's different from the other Jewish Museum in Berlin, how you, as a an architect interested in memory, saw a cultural experience in two different ways?
That's a very good question. I'm building the Jewish Museum of San Francisco. For those of you who don't know, it's a museum located right at Jesse Plaza at the Yerba Buena, in the middle of the city development, where the Museum of Modern Art, the Convention Center, the big hotels, the Marriott, and the new Four Seasons Hotel. Part of my project is inside of the old power station, which is the oldest power station, which is also a national landmark, California landmark, and it's right on the connector. It's right in the middle, in a hustle and bustle, in a site which is very complex, because part of the site is inside of the power station. Another part of the site is under the hotel. It's owned, it's actually built inside of the hotel. That's land deals and you know, sort of market economic understanding of how the city operates. So the hotel has the hotel and the power station are two large volumes within which the building is located, the Jewish Museum. And of course, there's some small aspect of the museum which also has a possibility of sort of getting out of the 19th and 20th century histories into the 21st and giving an expression to an important cultural institution. Now, it's not a museum about the Holocaust. It's not a museum in Germany. It's not a museum about what the Jewish Museum in Berlin is. It's really a museum about the ecumenical notion of Jewish culture as it has been seen in this country, particularly on the West Coast, the contribution. And it's really about life itself. It's about the ethics, the humor, the philosophy, the outlook on life, the questions that are raised by Jewish culture itself. And it is really not a museum really meant for any narrow body or group, but a very open matrix for the large overwhelmingly large public who is in this area, on the connector itself, there are 11 million people predicted to pass by just within a year on that little connector between the convention center and Market Street. So the museum is inevitably very different. How was it built? I based it actually on L'Chaim, which is the Jewish and the most quintessential, I think, Jewish idea, which is life. That whatever has been, whatever will be, it is all part of a living reality. And so I actually took not the high in some sort of symbolic sense, but to give the experience of the high. And of course, the high also has a mystical tradition, a very long one, as you know, because the 18, the numbers 18, which are associated, of course, with the Hebrew letters, and particularly with the high, are also the 18 points of the Star of David. They're also the 18, well, there is a legacy, not only in the Kabbalistic, but even in the Talmudic literature, already with the relationship between the text, the Hebrew text, which is, of course, something very special because it hasn't changed in all these years, in thousands of years. There's no change because the text itself is a proof of what it delivers as a message. And I took that concept, it's not even a concept. It's a way of living to bring the public into this new museum, which is also giving the public aspects of very old San Francisco and development of the United States. I'm describing it verbally. It's very hard for an architect to describe verbally what they're doing. But in any case, it's a museum that has a completely different light in it, a very different feeling to it, because it's also imprinted with the notion of the Pardes. The Pardes, which is the garden, as you know, the orchard. The letters, the Pei Resh Dalet Samach of the Pardes, are also, as you know, in the ancient literature, the four levels of interpretation, which are imminent in the Talmud, and the four levels themselves, let's say the elusive level, the literal level, the analogical level, the secret level, are part of really life. So the museum is literally alphabetical. It might sound in my explanation slightly alphabetical, but it is a literary museum, actually, because it's about the text. And it's about also the fact that whatever can be experienced as a text can also be walked as a field, because the chet of the chai is a field. And the yud is that break in the field. It's a mystical, really strange letter, because the word Jewish, Jerusalem, all those quintessential Jewish words start with a yud, and I've meditated on it for a long time. Why did it, because it's not really coincidental. There are other, of course, analogies and other synonyms. But anyway, I don't know whether I answered your question fully, but it's a different project, and I think each project has to deal differently with the world. You can't, most architects that I know of, even the very famous ones, they have a drawer with formulas, and they pull it out because economically very, very, that's why architecture is what it is, because you can't kind of invent it all the time, because it takes time and effort and money. So if you made a window, you just repeat the window 1,000 times, and then it becomes actually economically viable and actually a good window, because you can produce it quickly, cheaply, and so on. But actually, that was not my notion of a window ever, because a window should be always the first window. You should never have a second window. So if the second window is already not a window, it should always be the first window, like you've never seen it before, never looked out before, but it's hard. So I do believe, again, in the fact that every building is really closer related to a work of art than it is related to a refrigerator or a washing machine, because it has to somehow communicate, but because it's something which is made by somebody. Somebody makes it. Somebody has to take responsibility for making it. Many of the buildings that I know of and that you know of, hardly anyone would take responsibility for making. I just go into one of these big offices, and they can be even Pritzker architects, and ask them, who exactly made this thing? And they say, well, it was made by the office. It was made here with us. Who decided? Well, it wasn't decided by anyone. It's the inevitable product of a process of logic, which is difficult to turn, bend, send to a different direction. But it's something worth thinking about, because why should it be so difficult? Why should architecture be so resistant, where everything else is so irresistible? why should architecture be so resistant? And will it always be? Or will it suddenly become also irresistible?
Any other questions? Liliana?
I have a very, very different question. I remember in one of your earlier lectures, you showed slides of your projects, and in telling the story about your projects, you showed a slide of your passport. And I would like to spin this a little bit further and ask about the role of the architect and not just the buildings. You have drawn the comparison between Berlin, Osnabrück, and San Francisco. The museum where one cannot get out, the museum of the void, the museum of the celebration of life. When I remember my own experience living in Berlin, I had the constant feeling that I myself was part of a museum, stamped as a Jew. And I had seen the kind of allusion to this in your passport picture. So how do you avoid not becoming, or can you avoid this, not becoming part of the museum in Berlin? And how do you negotiate your role as an architect in Berlin with that in San Francisco, which seems to be so entirely different by what you are doing?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer very quickly, but of course they are very different. They're very different, and yet they are part of an experience. They're also part of my experience. Otherwise, I would not be able to do such a project, because they don't refer just to an abstract program or an abstract plan of a museum. I've often thought that when an architect has to research a project, go to the library and find out about what the program is, then he or she should not be doing the project, because the program should already be part of really almost the cellular structure of your being in order to be able to grasp even a tiny proportion of what it is to signify to others who are really to come. And of course, the role of the architect, I can't speak abstractly about it. I can only speak about my own role. I can't speak about generally the role of the architect. Because
I was more after not a general role or your role, but the simultaneous conflicting roles. The weight of being a Jew, an architect, a builder, a philosopher, are weighed obviously different whether you are in Berlin or San Francisco with one project or another. What kind of negotiations going on?
Well, sure, but I think it's true for everybody. It doesn't matter if you're a Jew or not, or whoever you are. You're always also someone else. You're not really just coincident with your name given to you and with when you were born. You are also somebody much older and much, at the same time, much newer than you were taken to be. So I think it's really a problem more of the identity, human identity in general, and a certain experience, having that experience. But I do believe that architecture is about having an experience. It's not about having a building. I mean, that's not really architecture. Most people think architecture is making the building. But the building is only a means for an experience. And that experience that I think is very important, which is to kindle that relationship with whatever it is that the program stands for. And it is very clear that the program of a Jewish museum is only a word in Berlin. By the way, when I started, it was not a Jewish museum. The project, as I often point out, has had already six different name changes, from the Jüdisches Abteilung, Jewish department with the Berlin Museum, and then to a department of a Stadtmuseum and so on. Now it's a Jewish museum, but it's probably not the last name change. It will inevitably become the Jewish Museum of Germany, of the state. It will be associated with the government as it has moved to Berlin and so on. But nevertheless, the space that you create, or that I wanted to create, is a space that is in some way cutting across the categories of naming it, because it seeks to speak to a single human being. And what does it speak with? It speaks with very traditional tools of architecture. What are they? They are materials. That's all architecture has. Not so many materials. There are not hundreds of materials. There's stone, there's concrete, there's glass, there's steel, there's zinc, there is, you know, there are not so many materials. Proportions. It's how the materials are being used. In what way are they being deployed to create, by their own opacity, a space between them? And the third, and I think the most important element, probably, is the element of light, which is really not really even a physical reality. Of course, you can measure it quantitatively, but light is also not something that that can be manipulated at will. And if it is, it's usually not something that we would really admire. So through those means, I attempted to communicate an experience, and that experience is different for different people. Very different experiences. It's not one experience. It's not a singular experience. It's about a certain kind of experience, a certain range of experiences. And people have different experiences in this museum, and as it should be, because it's not designed around a series of signs, categories, or codes of experience. And therefore the experience can also flip-flop. I've seen people in the void crying, but I've also seen people there inspired, interested in it, sitting and looking at it, and not at all devastated by the fact that there's nothing ever going to be there. So I think that's part of my view that of how one could do architecture, by simply looking at another area of reality, which is a central one to us as people, and not simply as users of buildings. We are so often reduced to a, you know, I mean, if you just go to any architecture office, you'll see yourself as some coefficient in a computer. You have been plotted into a function where you are just a number, a dot moving on a screen, which is hypothetical, body, being, human being, a person with dignity. But I think it's very bad to work that way. Of course, I have computers, we have computers, we all have to use modern technologies to be efficient. But one has to think, how does one work with all this in order to still give a dignity to space, a public space particularly, which has a memory and has a resonance. Now, you asked me about the passport. The only reason I showed the passport and I actually reproduced it here, because it was something very strange to me. I didn't really know what I was doing until somebody wrote that in my passport. You know, and as a reader, you know, you read everything. You read labels, you read what's on bottles, you read every detail. And I read that passport, and it was a strange statement. That was my passport when I entered Germany after winning the competition for the Jewish Museum. And a guard at the border inserted in writing into my passport, which is an American passport, a full page of handwritten in red ink, saying that I was able to enter Germany under the condition of attempting to execute and finalize and build the Jewish Museum Abteilung in Berlin, and then with a stamped, you know, official. So it wasn't really a normal visa, because a normal visa, and I, by the way, asked. I know the foreign minister. I knew all of the foreign ministers of Germany. So I asked all of them, is this a standard practice in Germany? And they said no. To their knowledge, in Germany, like in the United States, nobody writes in your passport. They have stamps. 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years, whatever. It's just a stamp, and then you go to the authorities and you renew your stamp. But in this case, it was interesting because I was entering with no reason, and the only thing I had with me was the letter from the center of Berlin saying that I had won this competition. And they said, so why are you in Germany? And I moved to Berlin in order to realize this building. I didn't move there for the, you know, building boom or the good weather. This was still before then. I took out my letter, and this person read the letter very, very carefully, meditated for a long time, and then transcribed exactly the words which were in the official Now, for those of you who don't know about architectural competitions, well, there's no reason you should, but most architectural competitions are really ways to forget a project, because you had a competition in order to forget. A competition is a political act. It's usually a ticket to oblivion. Look at the famous competition in Berlin of Mies, of Mendelssohn, of the Luckart brothers, of great architects, some of the finest and most powerful architects of all time. with all their unrealized projects. So winning the competition is really not at all a sign of anything but oblivion. And I read this oblivious statement in this passport, and I wonder, what did it mean? You know, what was I supposed to do with it? But I took it really as a manifesto somebody had written to me, and I struggled to keep up with it. And it was not always easy because the building was, it was not easy to build. It was at one point even scrapped. I don't even know whether people know about it. Someday a book will be written. It was scrapped by a unanimous vote of the parliament. They decided unanimously not to build it. And I found out the next morning from a neighbor of mine when I was leaving the apartment. He said, did you see the news last night? And I said, no. He said, oh, they just scrapped the building. I guess you'll pack up your bags and go. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, it was on TV last night. They just voted. So, yeah. So that's the ups and downs, but that's an adventure, and I think architecture is an adventure if you take it not as a, well, as a good job. Well, my wife often wonders, you know, why is it not a good job? Why didn't I do something other, which is safer and more, more secure? But it's enjoyable, actually, doing architecture, because it's not really doing it this way, and it's also gives a different, you find out, you get different people to converse with you, and you might even, if you're lucky, have made some contribution, however unimportant it is, to giving architecture some other aspect, which I think it needs for us.
Well, sometimes there's some more questions. Anybody else? Yeah. Okay, you want to change that? Sorry, we're switching our archival themes.
I wonder if you could say a few words about the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin.
It's being built. It will be built. It's a project that I don't particularly like. It's a government project. It's a federal government project, which is overwhelming in its scale and in its costs. From 14 million mark competition, which is what, about 7 million, 8 million, 9 million? How much would 14, 6, it has gone to something like 60 or 80 million marks. And I have my doubts I'm interested in memorials because they're very important. Of course, in Germany, everywhere else. But I'm very, very doubtful about this political act of the government. And it has gone against the grain of the public, public response. The public, will come there, sure, once a year during the memorial celebrations, whatever. But I think it just showed the dilemma of such a memorial in these times. And I wish it well in terms of its future success because we all wish it well. But it has problems, and I don't want to go into the problems from my perspective, but I will allude to one of them. The fact that the memorial is being built in an image of a cemetery, I think, is absolutely fatal because it is lying on the land of the former foreign ministry and actually right under the bunker of Goebbels, which was found during the construction, during the clearing of that site. And, people in the future will always want to know the truth. I think that's always the case. Shakespeare was right, that truth is the daughter of time, that forever in the future there will always be a question, and people will want to know about all the layers of decision-making, about any project and about any public project particularly. So it's just, I'm not really speaking too much about it right now, but I'm just alluding to the difficulties and to the also pressures. There are different pressures in that city in Germany which have made this decision, and we'll see. Well, I can only say, what will happen, we have to see in time, and the time I don't think is 5 years. You have to take the long-range distance in history of the city, look back at it, and we might not even be here. You know, it'd be, you know, much later. What such a form, such a memorial means for the city, and for the people, and for the public.
Any other questions? Up front first.
Coming to grips with an issue like the Holocaust must be an enormous difficulty for any society, any architect. But in that context, I would like you to comment on the one that the museum in Washington.
Well, I know Jim Fried and I know the Washington, the Holocaust Museum, which I think is a very, very good building. It's a building in America, in Washington. It has a very, it's completely different. I think the building that I designed and the building have almost nothing in common. First of all, their locations are completely different. The themes of the museums, the Jewish Museum in Berlin. By the way, the aspect of the void, the Holocaust cutting across the building, was not part of the program of my museum. There was no such part. Nothing in the program asked for that space. In fact, if you look at the document of the competition, out of the almost 200 architects who participated in it, the Jüdisches Abteilung was built as a cube, looking like a synagogue with its own little doorway, with a huge annex of the Berlin Museum. So it was seen as a private, small room for grieving and for the past nostalgia of what happened in that culture. I decided very early on that you could not really show Jewish Abteilung, the Jewish contribution to Berlin, without showing the connection, because Jewish people were involved in all facts of life. They were citizens of the city. They were Germans. They did not consider themselves as an ethnographic minority. They were artists. They were bankers. They were inventors. They were scientists. They were contributing to the city. So I felt that you could not really divide them, except in the fatality itself, into a kind of a zone which is called, you know, by itself, without any attachment to the history of Germany, history of Berlin. That's why I designed it that way. But to go back to your question, I think the two museums have really are very different, because the one in Washington tries to deal with simulation. It's about simulating, because of course this country, luckily for it, was not really directly involved. It wasn't involved. People died, soldiers and so on, on behalf of freeing people in those countries, but it did not happen here. So inevitably it engages the museum in a simulation just because it is here. And of course it has its own architectural metaphors and its own architectural language. The museum that I designed is really in the middle of the city. It's rooted on that matrix of addresses where people lived and worked and are really there, even if they are not there in any physical way now. They're there now because the building points in a very precise way through its organization to connections around the site which radiate beyond the site. So inevitably it's very different, designing a museum. And I think the question that you have is a very interesting one, even its implications, that much of our architecture is done through simulation, particularly today with computers and with cybernetic possibilities, of simulating spaces, simulating places, simulating relationships and experiences. Vis-a-vis an architecture which would not really be about simulation at all, would not be about quotation simulation reference, but would offer a connection of some sort done on an intersection of different planes of reality, not on a singular point of some sort of historical reference. I don't know whether I'm still being clear. Perhaps my flight has gotten to me.
Any other?
When you design a museum, do you think of the people in the country a great deal? Do you think of their anger towards that museum, their guilt, their feelings when they look there, when they come there? Does that take a tremendous amount of your thought process when you design your work?
Well, let me reverse it. I'm building now a museum. I was lucky to win a competition to build a museum in Denver, the Denver Art Museum, in the most wonderful, one of the most beautiful cities I've ever been to, right? Downtown Denver, right next to the state capitol. The question can be reversed. How does a museum like Denver Art Museum, how does it connect to the public? Since, it, by the way, it is a public project funded by the taxpayers in a bond initiative during the last elections. And it's the same question for all projects which are public. Whatever their emotive, programmatic specifics are, they have to connect with the public. Now, what kind of public do they have to connect with? Who do you go to ask? I've often thought about this. Who do you ask? You have to speak with people. You have to be there. You have to know the public. You have to be one of the public. You can't just design it for them from some faraway place. You have to be in amongst, and you have to know their deepest secrets. But how would you find those secrets? There are no ways to just go to the public texts and read what people want, how do they desire, and what did they respond to. You have to find it out in other ways. But I think it's no different from, since this is under the aegis of comparative literature, it's no different from the question of literature. I've often wondered, who is a poem addressed to? When Paul Celan says you know, who does he mean, you? When Shakespeare speaks about love in one of his sonnets, who is he addressing? Sure, we can go back to Shakespearean experts and attempt to find out, you know, was it a duke of this or a count of this? But no, I think he's always addressing, as any poet would be, addressing a reader that has never read this poem. Someone who is not even actually born in the time of the poem being written. So I think the question of architecture and emotion and who is it addressed to and what kind of reactions are there cannot really be done in any biophysical way. It cannot be done in any behaviorist way. It cannot be done as a functionalist formula of response and figure. It has to be done in a different way. And I have my own ways, my own intuitions, how that can come about. But again, architecture has very limited language. Of course, you can put signs, as the postmodernists, like Venturi, want, you know, say, okay, just, you know, right on top of the building, you know, I am a shed or something. But I think that's stupid because, okay, you can laugh at it for 5 minutes, but if the building is there for an hour, 2 hours, after a while, the joke, it doesn't work. So the buildings have to do it in a different way, and their limitations are not necessarily bad. Their limitations give architecture another strength also. So I don't really look for new means out of the architecture, now new technologies to get me out of architecture, but sort of seeing that architecture is a kind of a humble thing. It's a poor thing if you compare it to literature, compare it to music, compare it to art. It's a poor thing. You know, art is kind of amazing. Pure art, you can sit and do something, and it's totally independent. But architecture is really a poor thing, and it's poverty. Is actually what makes it so fantastic, I think. Because that's what I meant, that even 1 degree shift is seismic, given such a reality.
Well, I'd like to thank Daniel. A few last announcements before we leave. One, there's some wine outside that you're all invited to stick around for. Two, this talk will be available tomorrow at theorizing.org. You can sign up for the listserv if you're interested in upcoming events. And likewise, the Writer's House, which has made this event possible, there's a book outside, and you can sign up for those events as well. Okay, thanks very much, Daniel. See you soon.